The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon, and thank you to all of the families of our fallen veterans here on Memorial Day, and thank you to our folks who are still serving and our folks who have served.
Pretty much. Hello?
We can't hear you.
Hello?
Sorry, your lips moving, but there was no sound.
I was being a ventriloquist right there.
You know, one day we're going to check this
before we go on the air.
We just don't.
Yeah, happy Memorial Day.
Exactly. It's not a particularly... I always feel weird about that, though. But it is... it has become a three-day weekend. I don't know how long ago, but quite a while ago. And so it's somehow turned into barbecues and stuff, and I get that. But just got to remember what the day is all about. So, and there'll be lots of events tomorrow, for heaven's sakes, on Monday. Typically, Memorial Day, well, you know, six years in a row, you know, Memorial Day isn't on real Memorial Day. So there are events on the Monday, and then there are events on real Memorial Day. Tomorrow, they're all crammed on one day. People are going to be running all over the place. So we hope you can attend some stuff wherever you're local.
I think it's about boating and camping now.
Yeah, it's about wrecking the campground, actually.
Oh, that's true.
If you're here in Northern California. And littering.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. So here are we, the people. You are being joined by Aaron Ryan.
And Bill Cundiff.
And Bob Martin.
Because without one of us, we were screwed up. Together, we're kind of screwed up sometimes, too. But we're much better together than we are separate. So Bob handles all of our fun music. You have some good musical stuff for us today, Bob.
I do.
I thought you would. That's always kind of nice. So let's see. You can catch us on the West Coast here in Northern California. You can get us live from noon to 2 on Sundays at KCNR 1460 AM. You can always find us online, wethepeopleradio.us. And on Saturday? Are we 2:30 to 4 in Philadelphia?
I did not get to listen yesterday.
Okay.
The previous week we were 3:30 to 5 Eastern time.
I forgot to call Rick. So we're airing back there on the Conservative Commandos Radio Network at WNJC 1360 in Philadelphia and the Jersey Shore. And it's rumored to be on Saturdays from 2:30 to 4, but it could be at a different time.
It could be Mondays and Wednesdays. We're not sure.
So, stick with the website, you know. So at wethepeopleradio.us, you can always find all of our archives back to, 2010 or something. Lots of different shows, lots of different topics. And each of our guests, we put up a pretty good page on them and give you all the links to their websites and contact information, because you may know somebody who'd like to have them on a different program. We swipe them from other people's programs, so you can swipe them from us. And you can always use our archive for whatever you like and send it to your friends and utilize it. That's what it's there for. Today we have Nina Salerno. She is, I'll just read her bio here, an accomplished former prosecutor and deputy district attorney.
Go get it.
She is the owner of the law offices of Nina Salerno, a professional corporation, as well as an executive board member for Americans' leading crime victims advocacy organization. It is called Crime Victims United, and that is our topic today. She is one of the three daughters to the Crime Victims United founders, Michael and Harriet Salerno. Nina was 11 when her older sister, Katina Rose, I'm hoping I say that correctly, was senselessly murdered, execution style, on the University of the Pacific campus. Nina and her family quickly learned that families had limited rights, and through determination to change the law and protect victims, Crime Victims United was launched. She actually became one of the nation's youngest victims advocates when, at the age of 12, she testified before President Reagan's task force on crime victims and participated in various crime victim programs. So kind of an interesting life twist. Bad reason to do it, but I guarantee you a lot of other people have benefited from their family's tragedy. So thanks for taking time out of your Memorial Day, Nina.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me. I'm very honored to be on the show.
So that's all we know about you. So everything else you will have to tell us.
Well, you kind of heard but you're right. My sister was murdered in 1979 at the University of Pacific campus in Stockton. And my family took a very overwhelming tragedy because we learned through the criminal justice system that victims had no rights. And my father and mother and myself started Crime Victims United with the thought that my sister's murder was not going to go in vain and that we would make a difference. And so we've been advocating for victims of crime ever since. I also sparked my career. I served about 20 years as a prosecutor in various counties throughout California as well. And now I work as an attorney advocating for the rights of victims.
So what was different? Okay, did they catch the person?
They did. My sister's murderer was actually her boyfriend. My sister's case is kind of gave rise to stalking laws in our state. He had stalked her. He actually stole the gun from my father. He threatened to kill her numerous times. But those things were not loud in court because the laws were different then, and that's kind of what started this whole victim thing, is that we began to feel like that the victims had no place in our system. And eventually he was convicted of second-degree murder, which carries a life sentence. But in the state of California, life does not mean life. And, in fact, we're facing our 11th parole hearing July 13th in order to try to keep him in prison.
That's what I thought. I saw a letter going out from the office the other day, and it just dawned on me last night when I was working on the webpage. I thought, wait a second, I think this is all the same thing. So how often does that come up?
Initially in the state of California, paroles were 1 to 5 years, meaning that a person could see as little as a 1-year denial or as long as a 5-year denial. In 2008, which I helped champion here in California, the Marcy's Law came into effect, and it lengthened, and that was very important to me that this be done, and was part that I was involved in. We were able to lengthen denials from a minimum of 3 to a maximum of 15 years. With the idea that families wouldn't have to endure the intensity of a parole hearing, which is probably far more worse than the actual trial in many ways. The problem is we have been usurped by the administration on that. And so although families believe that they get a 3-year denial and at least have 3 years to have some reprieve, the inmate now is allowed to apply for an advancement. So the best way I can explain is 6 years ago, we received a 7-year denial in the murder of my sister in his parole hearing, and he applied for an advancement within 1 year after receiving that denial, was denied, but then was able to apply again. So now actually the parole hearing has been advanced by a year, which is very hard on my family.
No kidding. So
do they get to do that every year? I mean, can they apply for that?
It's like child support.
It's been so changed. Normally, they're supposed to be, they should have waited at least three and a half years before he could have applied. And then they said when they denied it the first time that he can't apply again, but then the rules changed administratively again, so somehow he got to apply for another denial. And this is not an unusual circumstance. He's a very sophisticated criminal. He's done this before. I actually had to litigate it. All the way to the Court of Appeal at one time, which led to a ruling that my sister's case was actually one of the worst cases for indifference to human suffering in the state of California. It was an actual ruling out of the California Appellate Court.
Oh, my gosh.
So families, it's just really hard on victims. Parole hearings are, you're in a small room. You feel like your fate, you know, relies in the hands of people that don't know you. You know, the inmates, some of them know well how to play the game, get their education program, yet, like in the case of my sister, he's very dangerous. He has never fully admitted to everything he did in the crime. Although he looks great on paper, it's the underlying issues. Like, I was the main witness because he threatened my sister in front of me. To this day, he denies doing that. So there's all these issues, and you have to relive not only the crime, because you have to hear the facts of the crime. Then you have to be put in the position of whether or not this person that's not remorseful or not rehabilitated is getting out.
And so back in the day when this all first took place, why wasn't the information that he was stalking your sister and all that, what was I don't know what I want to ask. What was allowed in or what wasn't allowed in?
And unfortunately, in those days, a lot of the prior threats, except for the one that I actually witnessed, was not allowed in. There were some that she told my sister after she received a phone call, things like that, were not allowed in because of hearsay rules. Those rules have now changed. Oh. I think our system began to understand that, evidence needed to come in, and not taking away the rights of the defendant, but I think we were able to, and I do credit Crime Victims United with quite a bit, and a lot of our public state, like the Mike Reynolds and Mark Classes, with coming to make legislative change so that there became more of a level playing field for public safety.
No kidding. It's hard to imagine that it wasn't that long ago those things were happening. How long did it take your folks to set up Crime Victims United?
They did it within, what happened was right after my sister was murdered, it had generated quite a bit of publicity around it. My family was involved in local politics. His family was rather well known as well. So we then were, at that time, President Reagan actually commissioned a task force on victims of crime. And I ended up testifying on it at the age of 13. And that kind of just started the whole thing. And then the California Correctional Peace Officers Union, which are the union that represents the prison guards, picked up on our first parole hearing, and that's what kind of generated everything. So it was within about 5 years. That was kind of a long-winded answer.
No. Well, I was curious about that. So, bottom line is you guys went from doing whatever you were doing as a family and you being a kid to you guys spent a lot of time in court and reading law books, I'm sure, and studying all that. How many other kids in your family?
I have another sister who's actually older. I'm the youngest, and she is a nurse. And then I went into the legal field.
Okay. So. Yeah, I'm sure this completely shaped that outcome. But I tell you what, if you were the prosecutor, I bet they were sweating bullets.
Thank you. It was a great job. I enjoyed my time as a prosecutor.
I'm sure you did.
You feel like justice is served when you're a prosecutor, and it was always just a good feeling.
Oh yeah. Well, and the people on the other side could never say, "Well, you don't know how this feels." You know.
Right. And it was really nice to be able to relate with the victims and feel like, besides, oftentimes I think victims feel like they're just a piece of evidence. And I think to be able to explain to them that I've been in your shoes.
Yeah.
There was a connection, and that's why I enjoy doing what I do now. I primarily represent victims of crime.
That's fabulous. Well, we've got a million questions, and there's a ton to learn from you, so we appreciate you hanging in with us. We're going to take a really quick break. We'll be right back. You are listening to We the People Radio. We are here with Nina Salerno from Crime Victims United, and I think you're going to learn a lot today. I know we're planning on it. There we go. The beginning of the break. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Be right back.
Go on, take the money and run. Go on,
Welcome back. You're joining We the People Radio. We are here with Nina Salerno from the Crime Victims United. Hey, Nina.
Hi.
So when did all this happen?
My sister's murder happened in 1979.
Oh, okay. The year I graduated from high school.
Yeah. No, she graduated from San Francisco High School. She was close to start the University of the Pacific the next day.
Oh, so she wasn't even in college yet. She was just getting started.
Yeah, she had just graduated Mercy High School in San Francisco.
Wow. So we were about the same age. And how long had she been dating the psycho guy?
I kind of had the quintessential life, meaning that he was literally the boy across the street. They met their freshman year, when he moved in the neighborhood, and throughout their high school, they dated. He was the star athlete out of St. Ignatius College Preparatory School. She was top student out of Mercy. And I think that was part of the reason, besides who the families were. Like I said, my parents were involved in local politics, my dad especially. His father was an athletic director of a big high school. And it was just, crime crosses all boundaries, but I think in those days this just caught a lot of attention because it was so unexpected of the, somebody out of one of the top high schools in the city and family background and things like that.
Sure, it wasn't like they were, it wasn't like they were hanging around downtown selling drugs or something.
Right. It didn't come from a non-privileged family, to say the least, so,
Sure. And was this kid an only child, or did he have siblings?
No, he came from a family of, I think he had four or five.
So, I believe
three brothers.
Well, how does it work when you go to these parole hearings? Does his family show up and just say how nice he is? I mean, because that's what you think, but I guess if you have a family member who has committed a heinous crime, you might walk away from him.
His family is not allowed at the parole hearings. Only victims' families are allowed into the hearings.
Oh, really?
I believe his family is very supportive of him. Yes, in California, we were able to establish that. And it's because the victim has the interest. Obviously, his family can write letters, and he does get letters of support as to why he should be released. But the victims under Proposition 8, Marcy's Law, and even prior to that, victims were allowed to be heard at parole hearings. Now they're not only allowed to be heard, they're allowed to be represented by an attorney if they choose. So we were able to expand some rights for victims. And a lot of that is because the board is supposed to consider the impact of the crime on the family when making their decision.
Okay. And then how do they decide? I mean, the person's obviously convicted of a crime, so they did it. Are they just weighing? I mean, I started reading your stuff, and I realized how little I know about, parole.
It's been very scrutinized by case law. There's a lot of litigation surrounding it. It went from that they could look at the factors of the crime, and based on the heinousness of the crime, they could decide somebody is a risk to public safety. Now, through the court system, that's not the case. You have to now find what they call a nexus between the heinousness of the crime and the conduct of the inmate. And you have to find that they are an unreasonable risk to public safety, but there has to be a nexus as to the time that they served in prison, what they've done, to the actions of the crime. And it's a pretty high standard, and unfortunately it can be very subjective, and it's been heavily litigated. And so I don't even know if you know, recently they've actually just made one of the Manson murderers eligible for parole.
Because they're saying
that the person spent so many years in prison, it's now far away from the time of the crime. The basis is they have to find that the person still poses an unreasonable risk to public safety. But the court system has made it so that it's a pretty high bar that they have to, it has to be met.
How much weight is there in their rehabilitation when they're in there? I know they come in and they no doubt are on their best behavior and they're remorseful and blah blah blah. But how much weight does that really hold with the parole board?
I believe it does hold a lot of weight. They do look at the programming and things like that. Unfortunately, at least it's my, and I do believe in rehabilitation. Let me put that out there. Crime Victims United is strongly supportive of rehabilitation, as I am too, because obviously if we can rehabilitate someone, we lessen the criminal out on the streets. But I don't think we do a good job of rehabilitation. And here's what I look at. Like, I recently just argued a parole hearing for a man who murdered his wife. She happened to be a federal Department of Justice agent when he murdered her, and it was a domestic violence murder. And although he looks great on paper, he'd done a ton of rehabilitation, I was able to point out to the board to say, that's great, but none of it had to do with any domestic violence. So I hope you don't put a lot of weight into it, because one of the things they're supposed to really look at is do they have insight to the causative factors of their crime? What caused them to commit this crime? And that's really the threshold. Do they have that insight so that they don't repeat it? Well, obviously, if they're doing programming in prison, but it has nothing to do with the actual elements of the crime, then I believe that they lack insight, and that makes them an unreasonable risk to public safety.
Well, and also, I don't know how you feel about this, but some crimes I don't feel you should ever be up for parole. I don't think you ever get out for. I mean, there's folks in there that have done things that, you know, we don't ever want them out on the street. And what do you say about that?
You know, and that's really interesting that you point that up. Yeah, because there's actually litigation coming on the ballot in California. I mean, initiatives coming in the ballot in California. Two dueling initiatives. One is to eliminate the death penalty, and one is to streamline the death penalty. And I actually just testified in the legislature because I believe. And I've seen it as a prosecutor. Obviously, the death sentence is reserved for the worst of the worst. It's very rarely charged in our state. It's a very, you know, you have to commit, and normally it's multiple murders in extenuating circumstances, murder of a peace officer, you know, had the murderers in San Bernardino County not died, they would have been eligible for the death penalty. So it's those kind of cases. And my point to the legislature when I was testifying is that we need to keep the death penalty in California, because effectively, if you don't, then life without the possibility of parole becomes the ultimate, and then that gets litigated. And what I had pointed out to them, there was a case when I was at the Attorney General's office called Robert Lee Massey. He was initially sentenced to death row out of Orange County for murdering and a robbery an elderly woman. By the Roseburg Court, he was commuted to life without the possibility of parole, then commuted again to the life with the possibility of parole. He was released, and 7 months later, he murdered a father of five.
Yeah.
And my point to them is that there are some people that just don't rehabilitate. And, you know, so we need to reserve those top levels, whether it's life without the possibility of parole or the death penalty, for the most serious of crimes.
Well, and then you've also got the sex offenders, which I think there's a lot of folks that believe those people cannot be rehabilitated. I think if you look at the numbers, most of them that are released do reoffend and are locked up again. What do you do with them?
Correct. Sex offense has some of the highest rate of recidivism. I did have the privilege of serving Placer County as the head of a sexual assault unit, a child sexual assault unit. And what I learned from that, a lot of that is psychological. And so it would take extreme rehabilitative measures. And it has been proven through time and time again that those are the highest of recidivism rates. And I believe some of the most dangerous criminals, because they tend to be very sophisticated, they tend to prey on people that they have that are vulnerable because they have a relationship with them. You know, it's very rare that it does happen, but that you have a stranger sexual assault or a stranger rape. But the majority of those cases, there is some type of relationship between perpetrator and victim.
Yeah, like you just, I don't know. Like this guy, does he just, I mean, when he goes into these hearings, do they, is it like he's, I mean, all our experiences, like TV, you know, movies and stuff. Does he dress up and have his hair all cut nice and, you know, acts like he's a choir boy and, you know, it was just some, you know.
You know, it depends sometimes on the individual roommate. They don't get to dress up. They do wear their, in California, they wear their inmate uniform. They are given an attorney, that's the state of California, should they choose, or they can hire a private attorney. It depends. they're given an opportunity. The way it works is the panel goes and they go through the actual crime. And like I said, it was my father 3 years ago, so this will be the first hearing without him. But I always felt horrible for my mom and dad to have to rehear what happened to their daughter. And, you know, my sister, it always shook the three of them very, very much to have to relive that night. And, you know, for my father, he always, and I think that's true with any parent, they always felt like they failed my sister, even though there was nothing they could have done. So that was hard. Then it goes into the adjustment in prison. So that's where you go through what they've done in prison. And then it goes to a phase of parole plan. Then what happens is the district attorney, if the county sends a district attorney, has the right to ask questions through the panel to clarify. His attorney, if he has one, has the right to ask questions. Then it goes back to the panel, then back to the district attorney. Then the inmate gets to make a statement, and then the inmate's attorney, and then the family gets to talk, the family of the victim. And that was something Crime Victims United changed. Prior, in our first parole hearing, the inmate actually got to speak after us, and it was pretty offensive because he pretty much tore apart my family. So we urged, and I have to say, California Department of Corrections did work with us, and we were able to make an administrative change where the victims of the family got to speak last, so they didn't have to endure being ridiculed by the inmate.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's kind of an overall scenario, and it's a very small room, about the size of the living room at best in most of these prisons, so it's a pretty intense situation. Quite honestly, my dad was elderly. My parents are elderly, so last year I had their private doctor even come last time because I was actually worried about one of them having a heart attack. Obviously, a great fear of him harming myself or my sister if he gets out. You know, our family's justified in fighting to keep him in, but we've been very vocal. Obviously, there's been a lot of laws changed because of my family, and I think he has a lot of a vendetta against him, and so that's always been my parents' fear.
Well, I you know, it's funny. That was one of my questions. I kind of forgot earlier, but I figure if somebody like that gets out, I mean, yeah, you go right back after the family.
You know, they do a lot of different things. I mean, he's been in there. He's been in there over 30 years. He's been in since he was 19. So I obviously, he's not going to have a tough time adjusting back into society. And there is a real fear. Like I said, I was one of the main witnesses because he threatened my sister a week prior to murdering her, and I was standing right there. You know, I was a kid, so I didn't say anything. I knew him. He apologized. So I've lived with that all my life, that perhaps if I had said something, maybe the outcome would have been different. But
yikes.
I can't change the past. But he adamantly denies it. And actually, he always basically, he doesn't quite say I'm a liar, but comes as close as he can. So that's always weighed with me, is that he has that much hatred towards me because he believes I'm lying in his mind. So there's those kind of factors that weigh in through my whole family. And I have a young daughter, and although she didn't know her aunt, she knows of the circumstances, and I see the fear in her when I have to go argue the hearing. So it permeates all generations of the family.
No kidding. And just keeps coming back up over and over and over again.
Correct.
Wow.
You know, you were talking earlier about what can and can't be used in some of these hearings and how some of the laws have changed since your tragedy. I just want to be clear that as those laws change, do you now get to use that information in those hearings?
No, because in the hearing, they have to, what is litigated in trial, if the person goes to trial, if they don't go to trial, it's within the probation report when they plea, are accepted as the true facts of the case. So no, you can. You know, I feel good that my family was able to make changes and bring about more of a balance in the scales for law enforcement, for public safety. It didn't benefit my family, and that's fine. We've been able to benefit going forward other people.
Okay.
But no, they have to only use, and our case did go to trial, and I've read all, you know, I think almost 4,500 pages of the trial transcript. So it did go to trial, and that is what is accepted as true by the board.
It seems not real fair if certain things could not be admitted at that time the laws change, and had it been allowed at the time, that the sentence would have been stiffer or different than what you're dealing with now.
Right, and I truly believe had things come in, it probably would have been very different. But then again, too, we have a balance in our system, and to allow things that were not allowed at trial would be unfair to the accused or the inmate.
I don't know, though. You know, you look at the people who've lost someone like your family. You know, here's a member of your family that was taken, you know, long before they ever really got to live their life. And you guys have to deal with this over and over and over again.
It's been tough. It's been it's a very tough road to go, but you have no other choice.
Exactly. When does this does this hearing come up?
This hearing is July 13th this year.
So it's right around the corner.
Yeah, so it's taking a toll on our entire family. I'm newly married, and my husband, who had never been, or I'm actually engaged, about to be married. It's even him, who just came into the family. It's a toll on him as well.
Yeah, it's like welcome to our little family project here.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. I guess we should, Bob, do we have to take a quick break? Sorry, kind of tardy on our breaks here. We'll be right back. We're chatting with Nina Salerno from Crime Victims United. Plenty more to come here at We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
So who keeps calling?
You're not going to get any defense out of Nina. She's going to chase you down and put you in jail. Good for her. So, Nina, talk to us about Crime Victims United. The note here on your site says it's the only organization of its kind using education, legislative advocacy, and political action to enhance public safety, promote crime reduction measures, and strengthen the rights of crime victims. I mean, that's a lot. That's a lot to take on. Uh-oh. Nina's been abducted.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear you. I dropped my phone, to be quite honest.
That wasn't you being abducted. I was like, so they sucked her out of her shoes. The aliens got her. Okay, your organization takes on a huge swath of work on behalf of victims. And it's currently in California, but you're spreading across the country? Is that correct?
We are currently, we originated in California. We are currently looking to expand across the nation. We are the only group like us in the nation that does advocate on a political and legislative level for victims. I'm working with, I believe you probably know who Sheriff David Clark Jr. is out of Milwaukee.
Oh, yeah, Wisconsin. He's great.
We're very good friends. In fact, he was our keynote speaker 2 years ago at the Victims' Rights Memorial that we hold in Sacramento every year in celebration of National Victims' Rights Week. And we've become very close friends, and so we're looking to put a chapter there in Wisconsin to help with their victims' issues. I have helped in the state of Louisiana. In fact, Louisiana, this is quite interesting, up until last fall, if a victim was raped and then went through a rape kit, actually got a bill to pay for their own rape kit. So that was something that we assisted in helping to change.
Wow.
And so we're working in that state. And I also have been contacted from some correctional officers I work with in Florida about looking at doing it. So it's my goal to help bring it nationwide. One of the other things that we did is when we did California's Marcy's Law, which amended the Constitution for victims' rights, and that was landmark. There was nothing like that in the nation. It has now proceeded to other states kind of as a national model. So we're working in various ways to work across the United States.
Well, that part is fantastic. So talk to me about what's going on with crime, with victims' laws around the country. Are they just, you know, still really behind?
It's definitely different in every state. At least every state now has some type of recognition of victims' rights. To the degree varies. California is actually one of the broadest, and I believe that's because we were one of the first, which is why it served as a model. But different states each have some rights. Now, the issue also comes down to enforcement. Even though we have these great rights in California, there's really no remedy if they're breached. And that's something that I've encouraged other states to look at. What do we put in place if there's a breach of, you know, and here's the best example I can give you. If you all remember when Governor Schwarzenegger commuted the sentence in his last hour of Bobby and Nunez's son.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you know the story. Okay.
And no, I don't know the details, but I remember it.
Okay. Fabian Nunes was Speaker of the House. His son, Esteban Nunes, murdered a young, very promising college student named Luis Scott Santos. And in his very last act as the governor of the state of California, I believe it was at 11:58 at night, with a stroke of the pen, he took what was a 17-year sentence and cut it down to less than 6. The family of the victims had never been notified, and we actually had in place that before a change of sentence takes place, a victim should be heard. So I, along with a partner attorney named Laura Strasser, actually represent the family of the victims and levied a lawsuit against the state of California, and we're actually still in litigation over it. Unfortunately, he's now been released. My hope was we were going to try to resolve it and the original sentence would have been put back in place. That didn't happen because he's been released because our court system takes so long. But now we're at least litigating to say that the arguments come down to it didn't apply to a commutation. And we're litigating that it does apply to a commutation. And we were actually able to amend the statute so it does apply to a commutation. But we're still litigating it just because I want the system to apologize to the family, basically.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
So we've gone from the appellate court and waiting to hear from the California Supreme Court if we're going to be accepted to be heard.
Yeah, because that's, I mean, let's face it, that's not fair. That's just a, you know, who you know justice system at that point.
Oh, it was such background politics because this kid Esteban was a cold, calculating murderer. There were two defendants, and what Schwarzenegger has tried to say to the public is, well, we don't know. He wasn't the actual murderer. There were two knives, and Luis was stabbed through the heart. Well, that's not true, because there was evidence pointing to both of them. Typical of co-defendants, they were pointing to each other, and it was actually going to trial. So, effectively, Governor Schwarzenegger has misled the public when he did that.
God. Wow. And so what happens? Do you deal with any of the stuff at the federal level? Because I know Obama's letting all sorts of people out and changing
sentences. What
I've done
recently at the federal level, it's actually kind of interesting. I've not done straight victims work at the federal level, but there is a movement across the nation that I don't know if you're aware of to eliminate bail. And right now I'm working with the bail agents In that litigation, there's been several there's a federal lawsuit filed in San Francisco, one in Sacramento, and a few other states. And some people think it's kind of odd that a victim would work with bail agents, but my point being is that I believe, and I've always been a supporter of bail, because bail ensures justice. Lots of times when we let these people out on what we call a promise to appear or own recognizance, the wheels of justice get halted. And they don't show up, and then court sentences and the victim's day in court get delayed. I mean, I believe in Sacramento County alone, there's something like 90,000 warrants. Most of them are these, I think all but 2% are due to people that did not show up for their sentences when they were released pending trial. And I just, for me, for the victims, it's important that whatever the outcome is, it's important to still have your day in court, and to have it halted because somebody was released with a promise to appear just seems offensive. Also in California, the Constitution says that the victim's safety has to be considered before somebody is released. And if they eliminate bail, that eliminates that component that I think is very important when you look at domestic violence, sexual assault cases.
Wow. Well, I think that anybody who's been a victim of violent crime would be happy that you guys are working on this, because it's a, you know, you have really two split camps. California, I don't know if it's just weirder than
California,
other states, but
you know, since the AB 109, we've got so many criminals on the streets now. And then they just release them.
Well, and then what, Prop 47, where they made a bunch of felonies, misdemeanors, and
Which made them less dangerous?
I don't know about where you live, but where we are, it's just, yeah.
There's definitely a spike in crime in California and actually across the nation. I believe California is meeting that spike in crime by statistics. And I think there's various things to attribute it to, and I think I'm a proponent of rehabilitation. I think it's important. I think it's extremely important, especially with juveniles and things. But I think what happened is some initiatives, some changes came in without a whole lot of thought. And you bring up like the lessening of some of the sentences. Well, what some people didn't realize in the state of California is what is called considered serious and violent is a very narrow category of crimes. It does not even include domestic violence. It doesn't include some child sexual assault if the child's over 14. It doesn't include assaulting a peace officer. I mean, some pretty heavy crimes are now, they were not considered violent or serious. So then their sentences got reduced. And
wow.
I think the intention and the philosophy behind some of these things are good. But I think the research and what is really important as to how we apply them is what's been detrimental.
I think it goes in waves. We had, I don't remember who it was, we had somebody on the program who was a nationwide crime analyst guy. And so he looked at trends over periods of years, and he said, you know, it happens all the time. You watch the laws get. You know, easier just because crime is down because we've had really stiff laws. So then you relax the laws, crime goes up. I mean, and then the crime gets out of hand, and you know, here we go again. So I think we're crawling our way back up to stiffer laws. We need to take one more quick break before the top of the hour. Sorry about that. Then we'll be back with Nina. And we're talking about Crime Victims United. We're talking about crime victims, actually. But the name of her website is crimevictimsunited.com. We will be right back. Okay. You're listening to We the People here at wethepeopleradio.us.
I hear the train a-coming. It's rolling around a bend. And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison. And time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps rolling on down to San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry.
I shot the sheriff,
but I did not shoot the deputy.
I shot the sheriff,
but I didn't shoot the deputy.
Yeah, no shortage of crime songs. So, Nina, we have you as our hostage for the second hour here, but before we close out this hour, Bill and I were talking in the break. What about those people who get arrested for a violent crime, then go to prison and commit another one? Like, he knew a kid. What was he, 16, 17?
Oh, he was a senior in high school, and they had a drug deal that went bad, and him and another kid pretty viciously murdered another schoolmate. They got caught. He went to prison for murder. Within a year or two of being locked up, he killed somebody in prison, and now he is in Pelican Bay. Now, how does a guy like that ever come up for parole?
You know, it, again, depends on how they're charged and what they're sentenced to. So it's going to depend. I can't speak to that case, but yes, they do, because it all depends on the sentence that they receive.
Oh, my gosh, because you would think that would be like, this one's a bad one, like bad seed, no parole.
You would think that, but it just, again, always depends on circumstances, the charging, and what the ultimate outcome is.
Hmm.
Wow.
So I guess there's always hope.
Yeah.
Yes, that's kind of how our system was designed, I guess.
Yeah.
No kidding. Do you find a big split between, like, grown-ups that commit crimes? And I don't mean, like, they're just over 18, but I mean someone who's, you know, maybe gets caught, who probably was a career criminal and gets busted in their, you know, 40s, say, versus somebody who commits a crime, you know, at 18?
Well, I mean, the code allows for several factors to be looked at. They're called aggravating and mitigating factors. Sometimes age comes into play, circumstances, home life, motive is big, things like that. So there is a lot of discretion, and I do, and all the district attorneys I work with in California, they do use discretion. Like, and as I can point out, the death penalty is rarely charged all across the state.
Oh, yeah. And we've got questions about that, because we don't know anything about that.
So it's all discretionary.
Ugh. Which I guess is good and bad, depending on who's doing it. Nina Salerno with Crime Victims United. We are coming back with her in the second hour. You've got 5 minutes to grab some coffee, or I don't know. It's a sunny afternoon. You might not want coffee at this point, but do whatever you like, and we'll come back with her in just 5 short minutes. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.